Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. Updates in parasites. This is an ever-evolving, changing field, and we got new bugs and new issues that we always have. I'm telling you, you got good job security with the one and only here, Dr. Richard Gerhold in the house. How you doing, Doc?
I'm doing really well. I'm having a great time, and I'm having fun because I get to talk about parasites.
So. Yes, absolutely. I know you're teaching parasitology right now to the vet students. So how's that going for them?
Every class says it's a really challenging class, but they really like it. And I say that's probably where it should be. Yeah. There's a lot of things to know with life cycles and evolving things, but I try to keep it loose and my goofy nature and everything else. And I enjoy the students. So I've been telling a lot of dad jokes.
You have to. Yeah. There's so much content in that parasites, though. You have to do it. So a little bit of information about our wonderful colleague, Dr. Gerhold. He received his BS in wildlife science and his DVM from Purdue University. And he's also employed as a staff veterinarian at the Southeastern Cooperative Wildlife Disease Study at the University of Georgia. Dr. Gerhold also received an MS and PhD from the University of Georgia in veterinary pathology, working on classical and molecular parasitology. Following his PhD, he completed a two-year National Science Foundation-funded postdoctoral fellowship at the Forestry, Wildlife, and Fisheries Department at the University of Tennessee, researching Lyme disease and tick-borne diseases. Dr. Gerhold is currently an associate professor of parasitology in the Department of Biomedical and Diagnostic Sciences, College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Tennessee. Duties include teaching in the first-year parasitology course and fourth-year rotations, diagnostic services, and research. His research interests include wildlife and public health-associated parasite epidemiology and transmission, protozoa transmission and ecology, avian diseases, and tick-borne diseases, and you can catch them in the speaking circuit. And he also put together a wonderful paper that we're going to chat about in a second that he co-authored. So lots of great information to get there. So let's talk about the paper that you actually just published recently. And what's something that the veterinarian should take away from that?
I would say the very first thing that I would take away from that is just because a parasite hasn't been found or documented in your area does not mean it's not there. We found these by happenstance that I had two individual grad students, one working on coyotes, one working on black bears, that just were doing really good diagnostics. And we got lucky to find this. And it just reiterates that there's a lot of emerging and new parasites in the area. And the other thing I would say is veterinarians absolutely have to go to CE meetings and keep up. Things change so fast that without that lifelong learning, you're going to get left behind really fast.
Yeah, this paper is in Veterinary Parasitology, Regional Studies and Reports, and it's called Two Cases of Angiostrongylus basorum, a cardiopulmonary nematode in a wild black bear and coyote of Tennessee. Interesting. Yeah.
So I think the most interesting part about this is it's a kind of a little funny story is so Katie was a master's student working on the black bears, and she came to me one day and said, I think I found Angiostrongylus basorum in the black bear. I was like, you're kidding. I said, well, tell me what you found and why you think it is. And she's like, well, the necropsy, the bear had severe pneumonia. And under the microscope, I see severe broncho interstitial pneumonia. And then intralesionally, there are dorsal spine larvae. And that's missing the metastrongylates, such as Mullerius or P. tenuis or Lower strongylus if you're a cat. But none of them are known to affect canids or ursids. And so we went ahead and did PCR, and the sequence came back, and it was, I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that. Well, the crazy part was about 2 weeks later, Eliza, a PhD student who just finished her DVM here, walked up and said, hey, we found Angiostrongylus basorum. I was like, yeah, I know. Katie found the bear. She goes, no, I found it in my coyote. I'm like, what? Like 2 weeks?
What are the chances? Yeah.
uses are so low. And I was like, and at first the question was, where was your coyotes from? And she said, oh, it was from just south of the Kentucky border in northeastern Tennessee. And I was like, well, that's really weird because the bear came from the Smoky Mountains, which is directly opposite of that at the southern part. So they were nowhere near each other, but they both had the same parasite within a 2 week period.
It's
Yeah.
wild.
And
Oh,
until that
interesting.
time, that parasite had only been reported in one other place in the United States, and that was a fox in West Virginia that one of my colleagues at Georgia had reported. And then bam, bam. And then since then, it has been reported, the first case in domestic dog in Washington State. It was a dog that was born in Oregon and moved to Washington State. So, we just don't have any idea where this, how,
Yeah.
where this. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself probably with the questions. You can probably
No, it's
help me.
interesting. It's great. Well, we're gonna pivot to a very common parasite that the listeners are familiar with, but with a little bit of a twist. We know about Dyrafilaria immitis, of course, hate heartworm. Is there another species of heartworm that infects dogs in North America other than that one?
Yes, actually it is. And it's the one we're talking about, the Angiostrophosaurum. It's often referred to as the French heartworm. And that is that the adults, they look very different from Dyrafilaria, but they have a similar location of where they infect at the adult stage. They are usually in the vessels, whether they aorta or potentially pulmonary artery. Unlike Dyrafilaria, which we're so used to seeing, and this long, maybe up to almost 15 millimeter, sorry, 15 centimeter, I get my 15 centimeter white thin worms, the adult Angiostrongylus, they're only about 14 to 20 millimeters, so much, much smaller, and have like a little pinkish hue to them. And sometimes they'll actually be inside the vessel wall. So you might have to dissect the vessel wall out to find them. But it's considered the most pathogenic lungworm of dogs. It's historically been found in Europe, Africa, and a few other locations. And the more recent findings prior to our findings, the one in West Virginia, was Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, Canada.
So that's interesting. And so, okay, so geographically it's been found there, but has it been found, what are the host species have been infected? I know we talked about the dog, we talked about the bear. Are there other ones?
Until this bear was diagnosed, it was thought it was strictly a canid parasite. That's the bear is the first report of a bear getting this parasite. It killed the bear. It was the cause of death. There was no question about it when you looked at the histology of the lungs. But fox, coyotes, domestic dogs, wolves. So it's considered, the natural host is considered to be wild canids, fox, coyotes. But then, as we can see, it potentially gets into some other species.
And are there clinical signs similar to that of heartworm, like coughing, for instance, or are there different ones and lesions as
Yeah.
well?
They're not much difference as far as clinical signs, coughing, respiratory distress, dyspnea. You're not gonna see that's you're not gonna see the reverse D on because of not having that same impact with the number of worms or size of worms. But clinically looking at it you really couldn't distinguish it from Dyrafilaria.
What about diagnostics then? Because I know, we have the antigen test. Would this come up if we're concerned with that parasite, or is it different?
So there is some thoughts that it can cross react with Dyrafilaria. There's a couple of different papers that kind of go back and forth about that. So the interesting diagnostics is unlike Dyrafilaria, which is the microfilaria are in the blood because of the mosquito vector. Since the Angiostrongylus is a metastrongylid, that means they use a gastropod, so snail or slug, as a required intimate host. So affected dogs that are shedding are actually shedding dorsal spine L1 larvae in their feces that will then eventually get into a gastropod. Other dogs are infected by either eating a snail or slug that has now the L3 stage, But also frogs have been shown to be a peritonic host. So there's potential different ways of infection.
And what can be done to minimize the transmission?
Yeah, that's a great question. So minimum of transmission is just if you're on a farm and a farm dog might be challenging, but trying to minimize dogs predating on wildlife, and also if you have an animal that just seems to really enjoy eating snails and slugs, trying to find a way to reduce that, you potentially could use some molluscicides outside of a pen if you're worried about them crawling in, the snails and slugs crawling into that area. One of the key features of this is we don't believe that the normal parasite preventatives that we give our dogs are effective against this parasite. So even if a dog is on its monthly heartworm preventative, or we don't think it's going to be effective against this parasite.
It's unfortunate. I was going to ask you that actually, considering like all the different types of preventatives that are out there. And I was going to actually ask you this one too. So I know they're talking about treatments on this, but we worry about, heartworm resistance overall. What are some comments that you can share with the audience about that? That there's is it on the rise? What are some things that we should be made aware of with heartworm in general?
Yeah, I think before I get into the resistance is kind of one of the things is compliance. And that's one of the toughest things. I think an owner sometimes has a hard time visualizing exactly the extent of damage that heartworms can do and why it's so important. I really advocate for all of our DVM students when they get into practice is to either purchase or some whether they're doing a necropsy on a coyote or a dog that actually has heartworms is to save that heart in a clear formalin container in their exam room so the owners can see the damage and the amount and this and so I think sometimes that amount of shock value can make them realize the importance and how lucky we are to have a preventative for such an important disease, you know. Other things I would advocate is making sure veterinarians are saying the right language. One of the things I think sometimes can get tripped up is if you're seeing a stray dog or a dog that has, has an unknown heartworm preventative history, and you do your antigen test and NOTS test. You may be initially tempted to say the dog's negative heartworms, but because of the pre-patent period and that we're blinded, honestly, for the at least the first 4 months, maybe 5 months of infection, what we have to say is, as of right now, your dog is testing negative, but I won't know for sure if your dog is negative until you bring it back in 6 months and I test it again, you know. And that, because I think if you don't use that terminology and the dog comes back in 4 months with all the clinical signs of heartworms, and you find, now your antigen test and NOTS test, you may be tempted to jump to like, well, it must have been the preventative didn't work. I put it on. When actuality, it's just the biology of the heartworm and our limitations in diagnosing it in that early stage or early to mid stage of infection. Now, getting into the actual aspect of resistance, it definitely is something of concern, particularly in the Mississippi Delta region. There have been increased levels of true resistance in there. I think the general aspect of that is trying your best to ensure compliance as much as possible. I worry a bit about the potential use of slow kill for killing adult parasites. Because you're putting an animal that's actually producing microflagellates of adults on the same medication for 2 years. And that's just really asking to select for a random mutation in a microflaria that has a mutation against that drug. And if that microflagellate is picked up by a mosquito and gone to another dog, then you have now created or selected for a resistant strain. So I really much advocate, unless there is a evidence-based research that an animal cannot tolerate molarsamine, that is the drug used to treat dogs.
Awesome. Great. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
All right. So pivoting back to our new parasite here, and speaking of treatments, are there treatments available for this parasite? Does malarsamine work for this one, or is it something different?
So what we usually use is a lot of our similar drugs that we've used. So drugs that have been shown to be useful for this include fenbendazole, include moxidectin, include ivermectin, include milbemycin. So those drugs have all been shown to be effective at treating this parasite. It potentially may take longer periods of treatment to, because you have that potential encapsulation of the parasite. And then treating, and then the larvae and everything. We do recognize that some animals treated for this, the dying of the worms can lead to some severe dyspnea because of the inflammation of the dead and dying larvae. So the reason I'm saying that larvae part is when the adults, they will produce an egg, but the egg goes to the lung of that animal host and it hatches out and the larvae are there. And then those larvae are coughed up and swallowed, and then passed out of the feces. But in that process, you can have quite a bit of damage that can lead to some of that problems. And then those dying larvae on top of it, they can cause an inflammatory reaction. So sometimes we have to put animals on diuretics, bronchodilators, or some oxygen supplementation to get them through that.
And any reports in people getting infected with this?
There is no reports of it being infected. So there's no zoonotic reports at this time. And like I said, other than canids, the only other report I've been able to find is our one report on our bear getting it. Interesting enough, the bear did not shed the larvae. The coyote we found positive did. So it looks like bears might be a dead-end host, but it definitely had morbidity and mortality from the parasite.
Awesome. Excellent information, my friend. Thanks for sharing all this good stuff.
This is exciting. It's crazy to find it, and I it's one of those things where I kept on doubting that we actually found it, but after getting redoing it and getting the same genetic sequences and making sure all our controls were right, and then everything lined up with what we saw in histology, I felt comfortable finally publishing it.
Right.
And it just goes to show that. Other thing I'll say is, I know sometimes funding agencies can think at just general surveillance of parasites, maybe what they consider a fishing expedition. But if we don't know they're there, we don't even know how to give information on protecting dogs or protecting humans or protecting other species. And so those surveillance studies are really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And CAPC, I'm a big fan of the CAPC reports too, just to look at trends and everything.
Absolutely. Yeah, those monthly reports are really important. So I just would say that any dog that has respiratory disease and you're not your normal suspects aren't coming up, it'd be worthwhile to either doing a Bear Med exam or I would suggest a zinc fecal float to look for the dorsal spine larvae, or to send them to a diagnostic lab and have them look for it.
I was going to ask that because do these diagnostic labs now know of this particular parasite to be on the lookout for it, since it's microscopically different than Direfilaria?
I think we're trying to get the word out. I would say if you're part of the American Association of Veterinary Parasitologists, yes, you probably know about it. But other diagnostic labs may or may not know about it. And so hopefully the continuing education of this will further keep their eyes open for this.
Excellent.
And I guess the other thing is just it's good to always remember to do a thorough exam, whether it's a thorough physical exam or a thorough exam on an animal, and not just say just by looking at it, you suspect it has to have disease X, and doing that thorough exam to make sure you're not missing something.
Yeah, absolutely. Always do a comprehensive physical exam, everyone. You heard it here from
Absolutely.
Dr. Richard Gerhold. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
This was so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listeners for tuning in. Don't forget to rate the podcast as we continue to grow and check out our Fetch conferences that we have throughout the year. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everyone.
you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.